Chapter 6. Free Samples from Mars. The planet Mars is, and has long been, a target of intense scrutiny and intrigue for the human inhabitants of Earth. There are probably a number of factors that explain why Mars, over other planets, has so excited stargazers and science fiction writers alike for millennia, but it may largely just boil down to the fact that Mars can be seen regularly with the naked eye, and maybe more important, it is red. Mars was first observed by the ancient Egyptians approximately 4,000 years ago, who, noting its red tint, cleverly called the planet Herdesher, meaning the red one. Early Chinese astronomers termed Mars the fire star when they started tracking its motions around the heavens more than 3,000 years ago. And of course, the battle-fond Romans gave it the name we use today after their god of war, a direct reference to its bloody coloring. But is this intense interest scientifically warranted, or is it just a psychological trick played on us by the cosmos? Is Mars the planetary equivalent of a mid-1990s cherry red Chrysler LeBaron convertible trying to look like a luxury sports car? On the red of Mars. Despite being its visually most recognizable feature, the red of Mars is literally only skin deep. Only the top approximately 1 millimeter of Mars's soil is actually red, so don't judge an entire planet by its color. Much like the crust of every terrestrial planet in our solar system, Mars's crust is primarily basaltic rock, but basalt is typically dark gray, too black in color, not red. So what gives? In the early days of Mars, its climate was much warmer and wetter than it is now, and the interaction of these warmer, wetter conditions with the iron-rich basalt caused the iron at the surface to oxidize. Oxidation occurs when an element reacts with oxygen. In the case of iron, reduced iron, or iron metal and FeO, is silvery to dark gray, and oxidized iron, Fe2O3, think rust, is reddish in color. Whereas most of the oxidation likely happened early in Mars's history, its iron is still being oxidized today due to interactions of various minerals when they are exposed to ultraviolet rays. Since oxidized iron is reddish, oxidized iron is what makes your blood red, this surface oxidation turned a lot of gray iron to red iron. As the planet's climate cooled and dried, the oxidized portions of the basalt became small particles of red dust. These red dust particles have since been blown about by powerful winds on the planet, covering Mars in a very thin veneer of fine red dust. Mars is undeniably red to the human eye, but the most interesting aspects of Mars are contained below its rusty patina. On the intrigue of Mars. With thousands of years of unassisted observation and 150-plus years of aided observation, it would be difficult to say when Mars's intrigue was at its highest. In all likelihood, ongoing and upcoming planned missions to Mars will continue to captivate the public with all things Martian. And if, or when, a crewed mission to Mars happens, even more eyes and minds will be on the red planet. While it is difficult to calculate peak Mars, it suffices to say that intrigue in Mars has existed for a long, long time. The modern craze originated with the Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli, who, looking at Mars in 1877, believed he saw a system of straight lines on its surface, which he called canale. In Italian, this refers to channels, but was translated into English as the much sexier and far more consequential word canals. This observation led him and many others to speculate that the canali were engineered by inhabitants of Mars. The great Nikola Tesla was intensely interested in finding ways of communicating with the inhabitants of Mars, and he spent a good deal of time working on this. This work resulted in the first radio-controlled robot displayed in Madison Square Garden in 1898. This invention set the stage for the radio-controlled satellites and spaceships that would eventually find their way to Mars. So, while Tesla never actively detected signals from Mars or sent signals to an advanced civilization on Mars, he certainly found a way to communicate signals from Mars, albeit more passively than he may have hoped for. To me, this is a great example of how science often works. You may not accomplish the goal you are looking to immediately accomplish, but your efforts lead to advancements that, in turn, lead to a general, greater understanding. Hooray for science! Schiaparelli's earliest writings about the advanced civilizations on Mars, they must be advanced if they were building these things, represented some of the earliest documented thoughts about extraterrestrial life on Mars. As additional researchers reported seeing similar things with other telescopes of the time, the Canali buzz increased, and by logical extension, the buzz about life on Mars did the same. In order to better study the Canali on Mars, by which he was fascinated, the wealthy astronomer Percival Lowell built the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. The observatory, among other notable discoveries, is credited with first identifying Pluto and remains one of the most important observatories in the world. As a consequence of the Canali craze, science fiction as a literary genre absolutely exploded, with countless works understandably focusing on Mars or Mars-based creatures. During this gush of new literature, H.G. Wells wrote his incredibly influential War of the Worlds, which directly excited multiple generations, first at its turn-of-the-20th-century publication to book readers, and even more so when War of the Worlds was read as a radio broadcast in 1938 to a panicked American audience, some of whom were unaware it was fictional entertainment and not just an accounting of a very eventful day of news on the airways. As I am always a sucker for a pointed political message, War of the Worlds was inspired by the British colonization of Tasmania and was a thought experiment by Wells essentially asking, what if Martians did to Britain what Britain did to the Tasmanians? Spoiler alert, Wells's musings go about as well for the Brits as reality did for the Aboriginal Tasmanians. However, the early 1900s saw the idea of Canali on Mars start to fall out of scientific favor. As telescopes and observations improved, the Canali started to vanish. There are channels and valleys on Mars, but they would not have been visible to these early astronomers. It was eventually shown that Canali were nothing more than illusions from the relatively poor optics of the time, and the Canali were only as real as the imagined advanced civilizations that built them. Through the early observation of Mars, the scientific community caused a worldwide stir about the possibility of life on Mars, only to eventually toss a big wet blanket on the idea as better technology emerged. But, Canali or not, curiosity in Mars persisted, from the imaginative writers of science fiction, to the interested public, to countless scientists of various disciplines. Intrigue of the red planet grew even sharper with the improved telescope optics. More modern studies of Mars. To say that Mars has been a subject of study in science is like saying that cancer is an area of mild interest for medical doctors. After many failed attempts by both the Soviets and Americans, the first successful space mission to Mars was NASA's Mariner 4, which completed a flyby of the planet in the summer of 1965. Since then, more than 40 space missions have been attempted dedicated to studying Mars by space agencies from the USA, USSR, and Russia by itself, the European Space Agency, Japan, China, the UAE, and India. Missions have ranged from trying to understand Mars quakes to the Martian atmosphere, the amount of water on the planet, and of course, to search for extant or extinct life. The amount we have learned about Mars and the rest of the solar system from these missions continues to fill volumes and volumes of scientific journals and books on the subject, and it's certainly not possible to summarize it here, But with scores of billions of dollars spent on scores of missions that have resulted in countless high-resolution images, uber petabytes of data, and multiple awesome landers roaming around, investigating and zapping things, none of these missions have yet returned any physical samples of Mars. But hark, we do have physical pieces of Mars. Indeed, we have over 150 kilograms, or 330 pounds, of Mars identified and cataloged here on Earth, and it just showed up. These free samples of Mars arrived as meteorites. They are no longer free. You can own a piece of Mars for yourself thanks to the many meteorite dealers that make a living doing this, but the cheapest will cost you at least $1,000 per gram. At the time of writing, there are greater than 300 approved meteorites of Martian origin, with more being found and recognized every year. The vast majority of these pieces of Mars have been meteorite finds, recovered during meteorite hunting trips in Antarctica or from the deserts of northern Africa and Oman. More important, five of these meteorites, totaling over 44 kilograms, were actually seen as they fell to Earth. The first of these falls witnessed by humans occurred in October 1815 in a sleepy area of northeastern France when an approximately 4-kilogram stone fell around the town of Chisigny. Another fall occurred in Shirgadi, India in August 1865, where multiple witnesses recovered approximately 5 kilograms of the meteorite shortly after it fell. Northern Egypt joined in on the fun in 1911, when the approximately 10-kilogram Nakhla meteorite arrived. A person in the area of the fall claimed that it landed on and vaporized a neighborhood dog. As sad as this sounds, this story is actually very unlikely to be true. No physical evidence for this was ever found, and language translations of the area and time could easily be interpreted that it landed near a dog and scared it away. Let's go with the second. It's far more likely, and will also keep people from hating meteorites. About 50 years later, in 1962, the largest witnessed fall yet of a Martian meteorite occurred in Nigeria with the meteorite Zagami. This 18-kilogram stone implanted itself 2 feet into the hard ground, only a few meters from a likely very startled local farmer. The most recent witnessed sample to fall to Earth from Mars was the 2011 Tisant meteorite. Tisant arrived with multiple loud booms and an accompanying light show in the early morning hours of July 18th in Morocco, with its pieces found starting 3 months later in the area 48 kilometers from the town of its namesake. Even though these meteorite falls arrived on Earth in the last 200 years, they did not come here on a direct path from Mars, and they were certainly not known to be from Mars when they arrived on Earth. It takes multiple scientific studies to determine the source of a meteorite. It cannot be done definitively by hand specimen alone. Modern-day investigations of Chisigny and Nakhla show that they were launched from Mars about 10 to 11 million years ago, whereas Shirgadi and Zagami spent about 3 million years cruising the solar system before they made their crash landings on Earth. Tisant, a 595 million-year-old rock, only floated around space for about 1 million years after it was jettisoned from Mars, taking a more direct path than the others to Earth. How do we know these rocks are from Mars? When collisions in space occur, rocks can break free from their apparent masses. If the wayward rock has a high enough velocity to escape the gravity of the main mass, cleverly termed escape velocity, it will not return to the surface of its parent rock, but will fly aimlessly off on its own until it eventually runs into something else. Earth, in these cases, is that something else. Most rocks that journey to Earth come from the asteroid belt, where the parent asteroids are relatively small compared to planets, meaning they have much less gravity to overcome and therefore require a lower escape velocity. Mars is not a huge planet. It is only about half the size of Earth, but it is still a planet, and it has significant gravity and therefore a significantly larger escape velocity than any asteroids in the solar system. It takes a large collision to get rocks off the surface of a planet like Mars, and as such, it was thought to be very unlikely that we would have pieces of Mars come to us in the form of meteorites. The escape velocity to get off of Mars is on the order of 11,000 miles per hour. Volcanic eruptions do not produce rocks flying at these speeds, so the only realistic way this could happen is from large impacts on the surface of the planet. Yet, these weird rocks in the world's meteorite collections did not fit with anything else. These special rocks had young formation ages, oftentimes billions of years younger than other known meteorites, meaning they were from a geologically active body. There are very few geologically active bodies in the solar system, and this alone suggests that these samples came from a very large object, such as a planet. Importantly, the interplay of 1. Planet size, and 2. Location in the solar system relative to the Sun, are very important when calculating the likelihood of creating potential meteoritic material on Earth. These factors are very much working against having any meteoritic material from Mercury or Venus, but it's dangerous to say something is impossible. It is, however, unlikely that Earth will ever receive meteoritic material from Mercury or Venus. Specific minerals indicated these rocks were in contact with liquid water at some point, another feature not common among normal meteorites. These strange rocks had chemical and isotopic signatures very different from other meteorites, suggesting they originated from a very different place. This troublesome group of meteorites was just simply different from other meteorites. There was speculation in the meteorite community that this group of rocks could be sourced from Mars, and this speculation only increased when data from the Viking landers in 1976 showed rocks on the surface of Mars chemically had a lot in common with these strange meteorites. Then, in 1983, scientists showed that the composition of the trapped gases in these unique meteorites was a direct match to the gas in the Martian atmosphere, measured directly during the Viking mission, leaving little doubt that we actually had chunks of Mars on Earth in the form of meteorites. After scientists knew which rocks here on Earth were actually interlopers from Mars, interest in these particular samples surged. This cache of rocks allowed scientists to look in incredible detail and learn an incredible amount about the geology and environment of Mars, science that was and continues to be impossible using remote techniques. Hundreds and hundreds of research papers have been generated on these rocks since, yet, of all the interesting research coming from these pieces of Mars, one study has garnered more attention than possibly all of the others combined. The story of Alan Hills, 84001. It all started, at least for the human-related part of this story, in 1984 during the yearly meteorite collection trip to Antarctica. More about these incredibly interesting and fruitful meteorite collection trips in Chapter 7. The first meteorite that was found that year, per convention, was named Alan Hills for the area it was found, and 84001 for the year of the expedition and sample number, leading to its designation as ALH-84001. And ALH-84001 turned out to be quite the doozy of a potato-sized rock. It was originally thought that the rock might be related to a class of meteorites called the Diogenites. But in 1994, this strange rock was recognized to be a piece of the planet Mars. This class of meteorites is named after the Greek philosopher Diogenes of Apollonia, who reported the stone that fell at Aegispotami around 465 BCE, correctly hypothesizing that falling stones were not from Earth. This was exciting news in itself, as there were only a handful of meteorites with a confirmed Martian origin at the time. However, the biggest news stories about this sample were still a couple of years away. On the 6th of August, 1996, NASA released a statement from its administrator, Daniel Golden. It was a thrilling yet measured statement about an upcoming paper in the journal Science regarding an exciting potential finding from the meteorite ALH84001. NASA has made a startling discovery that points to the possibility that a primitive form of microscopic life may have existed on Mars more than 3 billion years ago. The research is based on a sophisticated examination of an ancient Martian meteorite that landed on Earth some 13,000 years ago. The evidence is exciting, even compelling, but not conclusive. It is a discovery that demands further scientific investigation. NASA is ready to assist the process of rigorous scientific investigation and lively scientific debate that will follow this discovery. I want everyone to understand that we are not talking about little green men. These are extremely small, single-cell structures that somewhat resemble bacteria on Earth. There is no evidence or suggestion that any higher life form ever existed on Mars. Statement from Daniel S. Golden, NASA Administrator, August 6, 1996. The following day, President Bill Clinton stood on the White House's South Lawn and discussed the significance of the study. Shockingly, the only questions by White House reporters for the president following his remarks on the potential for life existing outside of Earth were, first, about 1. The latest Republican-led attempt to restrict abortion, and then, 2. His necktie choice for the day. No questions at all about life on Mars. How do you hear that announcement, that we may now have evidence that we are not alone in the universe, and wonder, "Where'd you get that tie?" Which is, unfortunately, a direct quote from the presidential press corps that day, and 50% of the questions asked. This is not a joke. It actually happened that way. You can watch the exchange on archived video of the press conference. The president's statement, along with remarks from the authors during NASA's more extensive press conference, were clearly excited, yet also guarded. In particular, statements by Dr. Everett Gibson, second author on the paper, echoed the magnitude of the study but also displayed important scientific restraint, even in the face of a potentially humanity-changing discovery. "For 2 years, we have applied state-of-the-art technology to perform these analyses, and we believe we have found quite reasonable evidence of past life on Mars. We don't claim that we have conclusively proven it. We are putting this evidence out to the scientific community for other investigators to verify, enhance, attack, disprove if they can, as part of the scientific process. Then, within a year or two, we hope to resolve the question one way or the other." Dr. Everett Gibson, co-author, NASA Press Conference, August 7, 1996. Dr. Gibson certainly got his wish. Simultaneously with the feeding frenzy that developed in the press after NASA's announcement of potential evidence for life on Mars, scientists from multiple disciplines started to weigh in on the study almost immediately. Many of the arguments were debated, but the most important and most contentious lines of argument from the paper in support of fossil life in the carbonate veins of ALH84001 are summarized here. Found in ALH84001 are 1. Organic molecules called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, indicative of degraded organic matter from Mars. 2. Various mineral grains that are indistinguishable to those formed by some Earth bacteria. And 3. Bacteria-shaped objects in ALH84001, and these could be mineralized remains of bacteria that lived on Mars. Immediately following the release of the manuscript, many scientists started pointing out flaws in these conclusions. This actually happened prior to the release of the article. In addition to the normal peer review process for scientific manuscripts, subject matter experts in areas like paleobiology and evolutionary biology were asked by NASA to evaluate and comment on the landmark research well before and again during the August 7th press conference. One such expert was J. William Schropf, who was the designated skeptic at the NASA press conference. Schopf has since written extensively on the topic and the unique experience he had. Among other works, his 1999 book, Cradle of Life, includes a lengthy discussion of the events surrounding the claims of possible life on Mars from work on ALH 84001, which is worth a read if the intersection of science, politics, and media interests you. This healthy dose of skepticism, compounded over time as hundreds of experiments and studies were launched, related to how such microfossils could have come to be, or how the observations made about ALH 84001 could have had origins other than biologic activity. An extensive list of arguments levied against ALH 84001, hosting evidence of early life on Mars, fills entire journal editions, but here are just a few of the clearest examples. Of the three primary claims of evidence for life noted above, the first two are refuted in a similar way. First, organic compounds such as PAHs can be the products of degraded organic matter such as dead trees, bacteria, or iguanodons, but they also form through inorganic processes as well. Such non-biologically produced organic molecules are common constituents of many other carbon-containing meteorites, such as those discussed in the previous chapter, which are undisputedly produced by non-biologic activity. As such, finding PAHs is not evidence of past life. It is just evidence that carbon was present in this meteorite and PAHs formed. Similarly, versions of the various mineral grains found in ALH 84001 and used as evidence of past life can be produced by bacteria on Earth. However, normal geologic processes routinely form the same mineral assemblages, with biology playing no role whatsoever. Again, finding this mineral assemblage is interesting and tells us something about the environment present, but it is in no way indicative of life. Lastly, the images of worm-like objects from ALH 84001 certainly resemble rod-shaped bacteria found on Earth and certainly look like evidence of past life when put side by side with certain types of modern bacteria. This is exactly why these images were the darlings of thousands of news stories about the evidence for past life on Mars. But scale matters a lot. The sizes of the ALH-84001 microfossils found under the microscope are about 1,000 times smaller than the majority of bacteria on Earth, and about 1/10 of the size of the smallest known bacteria. This may be a bit troubling, but the fact that they are so much smaller than known life is not the biggest issue. The real problem is that there is a physical limit to how small life can be, if it is at all similar to life on Earth, and, well, that was the comparison after all. If these ALH-84001 objects were at all similar to bacteria, or really any living cell on Earth, they would need a cell membrane. Such membranes are constructed with a protein-lipid bilayer protein sandwich, which takes physical space. And the smaller the cell, the more significant amount of space this membrane takes from the inside of the cell. Given the dimensions of the ALH-84001 specimen, the inside of the Martian cell, where all the functions of life would take place, would be approximately 2,000 times smaller than the space available inside the smallest known living organism. These tiny sizes may be a bit difficult to picture because, well, they are so small, we have no chance of seeing them without a very powerful microscope. But if you think about it on more of a human scale, think of automobiles and the popular micro-machines replica cars popular in the 1980s and 90s. Micro-machines were an approximately 1 to 100 scale of cars we might see driving around on the road. In this analogy, this means if a car a human could drive is the normal bacterial cell, the Mars equivalent would be 20 times smaller than the micro-machine replica, but still, somehow, able to fit a human driver. Not bloody likely. As the evidence, studies, and informed opinions rolled in from a variety of disciplines in years following the 1996 paper, it became more and more apparent that the microfossils found in ALH84001 did not meet the community's standards for proof of previous life on Mars. The proposed evidence of life in ALH84001 was formed by inorganic processes and not from ancient Martian critters. Again, it seems, scientists created, then rapidly quashed the idea of life on Mars. But if you think version 2.0 of the scientific wet blanket on Martian life stifled the public's desire for information about Mars, you are very wrong. If anything, it greatly intensified it. The consequences of ALH84001. Following the ALH84001 study and the ensuing controversy, enthusiasm for Mars research grew exponentially, creating an even more intense focus on Mars from the planetary science and space exploration communities. Mars missions already underway received increased attention, and multiple missions to Mars were greenlit from a variety of space agencies. Funding was redirected to Mars research, much to the dismay of other programs, and the field of astrobiology took off like a Saturn rocket. For better or worse, the 1996 study caused irrefutable changes to the arc of planetary science research. While it is impossible to list things we might have learned if resources hadn't been redirected to focus on Mars-related science, there are certainly a lot of things that we did learn because of it. For one, in trying to develop a better understanding of what life on Mars could look like given its non-Earth-like environs, past and present, scientists sought out and intensely studied extremophiles, or life at the margins on Earth. This term is, of course, a very anthropocentric view of what extremes are. It may be extreme to us, but for these organisms, their environment is totally normal, or even necessary. The search for alien life on Earth, or life that looks and behaves significantly different from life in middle-of-the-road environments, has led to a far greater understanding of where life is possible and what is happening with life in conditions humans deem extreme. Due to this work that was largely performed after 1996, we now know life exists in places previously thought impossible. Life has been found in extreme acids or bases, ranging in pH from 0 to 12.5, temperatures ranging from -20 to 122 degrees Celsius, or -4 to 252 degrees Fahrenheit, and at the crushingly high pressures found deep within the ocean or Earth's crust. Life exists in toxic waste dumps and in hypersaline solutions like the Dead Sea. Certain organisms are even adapted to exist when exposed to very high levels of ionizing radiation, requiring extreme protein protection and cell maintenance to avoid lethal damage or mutations. The amount we have learned about what life can put up with in the last few decades is astonishing. Not only has this multitude of discoveries pushed the boundary conditions of life further and further, but it has made the idea of life existing under the previously thought inhospitable conditions on other planetary bodies far more conceivable. And this discussion doesn't even touch on how much this research on extremophiles has increased our fundamental understanding of basic biological processes, species evolution, or the potential, and realized, medical and biotechnology advancements. And while a better understanding of extreme environments that might be possible to host life is valuable in its own right, observational and robotic missions have actually found evidence that not-so-extreme conditions were present on Mars in the past. Evidence of lakes and rivers of liquid water on Mars has been found, and the clay minerals deposited in that water suggest this ancient environment could have supported microbial life. The infamous 1996 paper on ALH84001 did not find ancient life on Mars. But in the long run, it indirectly found out that Mars was a habitable place for about 1 billion years in its early history. The importance of water on Mars. The most basic things that life requires to exist are 1. A source of energy, 2. Basic materials for building things, and 3. A liquid solvent to move those things around in. Most places in the known universe don't seem to struggle with the first two requirements, so it is access to the third that is likely the biggest bottleneck for life. And since all life that we know of uses water as that liquid solvent, it is commonly said that life cannot exist without liquid water. Entirely true or not, it certainly seems like that could be the way it is. As such, evidence of the presence of liquid water on Mars is a really big deal for people who care about things like, well, life on Mars, or, on a much bigger scale, contemplating our place in the cosmos. Whereas remote techniques have been crucial for qualitatively showing that water once existed on Mars, it is only through the study of Martian meteorites that we can quantify the amount of water that was present, and how much has been lost over time. Just as scientists can pair information from meteorites with the remote techniques studying modern Mars, we can do the same in investigating the climatic and atmospheric evolution of Mars. Thanks to the Martian meteorites in our collections, we have time capsules of Mars spanning almost the complete history of the planet. Briefly, the geologic history of Mars is broken into 3 main periods: the Noachian, Hesperian, and Amazonian, each named after areas on the surface of Mars that typify the geologic periods. The Noachian, the era just following formation, was warmer and wetter than it is currently, probably due to a high amount of volcanic activity releasing greenhouse gases and keeping the planet's surface temperature up. During this period, Mars was able to sustain liquid water in its large basins, especially at low latitudes. If life ever developed on Mars, this first approximately 500 million years would be its most favorable window, by far, and the type of environment the rover Perseverance is exploring. The meteorite ALH84001 is from this earliest period, which added intrigue, since it was thought at the time that this would have been the period to develop life on Mars if it ever did happen. Next, the Hesperian, spanning from approximately 3.7 billion to 3 billion years ago, saw the climate turn much drier and much colder. The liquid water that was likely once abundant on the surface became more localized and eventually disappeared through freezing, sublimation, and loss off the planet. Lastly, the Amazonian, the period Mars has been stuck in for approximately 3 billion years, is characterized by very cold and hyper-arid conditions. Not a great rut to be in as a planet, but it certainly is still better off than Venus or Mercury. The ages of things. Knowing the age of a sample is one of the fundamental pieces of information needed to reconstruct a geologic environment, whether you are working on Earth or working on other planetary bodies. That's basically what geologists are always trying to do: look back in time to figure out what happened, and then go have a beer or four with their colleagues. The chronologic studies of Mars come in 2 main flavors: those done using remote techniques to find out how old various parts of the surface of Mars are, and those done on Martian meteorites in the lab to find out how old each individual rock is. The first is done using satellite imagery, meticulously looking at the amount and size of craters on the surface, and converting that into an age of how long that surface has been exposed to the wilds of space. The basic premise is that old surfaces have seen a lot of impacts, and young surfaces appear fresher since they have not been assaulted by asteroids for quite as long. Think of it as a car hood from Missouri, my home state and land of periodic hailstorms. A brand new car in Missouri will have a nice, undented hood, whereas a 20-year-old car will have seen multiple major and a lot of minor storms with plenty of damage to show for it. The same is basically true for the surfaces of Mars. Older surfaces are pocked with numerous craters of multiple sizes, whereas young areas of Mars are flatter and only have smaller craters. As discussed in Chapter 1 for Earth, large impacts on Mars are far less frequent than small impacts. This method is a great way to determine relative ages of large areas, but a lot of assumptions go into it. Most important, one has to know the rate of impacts, or how often hailstorms occur, which can only be calibrated if you independently know the age of the rock layer. This method for Mars is calibrated using rocks from the lunar surface collected during the Apollo missions and crater counting on the Moon. Scientists have taken the rate of rocks hitting the Moon and mathematically transferred this to Mars using a fudge factor for their different locations in the solar system. This is not a method without uncertainty, but it works well for relative ages. The second flavor of chronology, dating meteorites from Mars in the laboratory, is near and dear to my heart from my previous research on this subject. To be honest, a mix of near and dear and a little traumatic, since it is so damn difficult and time-consuming. Without getting into the gruesome details, the method involves separating minerals from one another in the rock, then measuring the elemental and isotopic ratios of the mineral separates. Because most rocks contain numerous radioactive isotopes that can be used as clocks, this allows the age of the rock to be calculated alongside other ancillary information you pick up in the process. In most cases, a gram or so of an individual rock is sufficient, but because individual mineral phases have to be separated and cleaned to do this, it can take more than 6 months of work in the laboratory to determine such an age. I can speak from experience here. It took me over 3 months of staring down a microscope using a tiny pair of tweezers and many audiobooks just to isolate and separate the mineral phases needed to get a crystallization age for the Martian meteorite Thiessen. This was the first and last Martian meteorite that I did chronology on. Luckily, there are a lot of good and patient people that do this in the community, and the age range of the greater than 300 Martian meteorites spans from approximately 4.1 billion years old to a scant 160 million years ago. In other words, for nearly the entirety of Mars's history. Other than just the ages, this chronologic work on Martian meteorites has provided us with an incredible amount of information about the interior of Mars that we would not possess otherwise. For instance, we know that the multitude of volcanoes on Mars tap different reservoirs in the Martian mantle, and that mantle has many regions that are vastly different from one another. Because plate tectonics does not occur on Mars, these mantle reservoirs don't get mixed up like they do on Earth. Also, because the Martian meteorites in our collection span almost the entire history of the planet, we know that Mars has been geologically active for 4 billion years or more. This means that the surface of the planet is actively being altered from things like volcanic activity or tectonics. Impacts don't count because the planet is not really doing anything. It is just passively taking a punch. This fact alone allows scientists to estimate the heat flux of the interior of the planet, informing us about how much radioactivity is present from elements like uranium, thorium, and other long-lived radioactive isotopes, which are important heat sources for planets. Additionally, the chronology of Martian meteorites not only taught us that Mars formed as a planet very early, within the first 10 million years of the solar system, but we also know that it formed a core, crust, and atmosphere somewhere between 20 and 40 million years after the start of the solar system. Numbers like these may just seem like dates on a timeline, but they are critical for a broad understanding of how planets form and evolve, not only in our solar system, but also in other stellar systems. On the importance of samples. One of the reasons meteorites from Mars, and other meteorites in general, have been so important for our understanding of the entire solar system is that Mars is the only other external planet we have samples from. Because Earth underwent a massive moon-forming impact that melted everything within the first couple hundred million years, erasing a lot of information of its earliest history, it's very difficult to find anything here older than 4 billion years, making Earth a less than ideal place to look for clues about planet formation and the early solar system. The oldest dated sample on Earth is around 4.4 billion years old from the Jack Hills region of Australia. And it's not even a real rock. It's just a tiny, yet robust, mineral leftover from a previous generation of rocks, squished in with other rocks. Since the moon-forming impact, it hasn't gotten much easier, as plate tectonics has repeatedly melted and shuttled most of Earth's rocks around. If we only had rocks from our home planet to look at, we would be far less informed about terrestrial planet formation than we are now. Over the years, Mars exploration has been focused on remote techniques, and that's understandable, given the technological and resource challenges of crewed or sample return missions to Mars. We have certainly learned an amazing amount with the plethora of fancy instrumentation, telescopes, orbiters, landers, rovers, etc. But there are many things that need ground truth, which can only come from having the sample in a laboratory. There are a lot of things that remote techniques simply cannot do, no matter how cool they look or how much they overperform. Famously, the Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity were planned missions that were expected to last just under 90 days. They both landed in January 2004. Spirit was active until March 2010. Opportunity made it until June 2018. Not bad. The stash of Martian meteorites we have in our collection, and the new ones we will get, are a huge boon to the planetary science community. And while the meteorites we have allow us to really dig into the details of the planet, the downside is we don't really know where these meteorites came from on Mars. And that is a major problem. There is no geologic context, just a chunk from the planet from some unknown random place. With the geochemical data from both meteorites and remote sensing, paired with the high-resolution maps of Mars, it is tantalizing to try to locate the specific craters on Mars responsible for these special deliveries to Earth. Thus far, this has been attempted, but not conclusively done. However, the possibilities have been greatly narrowed, and the search continues. With the recent space exploration success by private companies, such as SpaceX, and the continued interest and accelerated collaboration between governmental space agencies, the possibility of returning samples from Mars is becoming ever more tangible. But if or when we get to a point where we bring samples of Mars back home, they will be chosen types of rocks, not just the random rocks from random locations that are launched off the surface and happen to survive the unlikely journey to Earth. The chosen pieces will be carefully selected to get the most scientific value possible from each sample. Given the cultural curiosity about life on other planets, the chosen rocks will likely be parts of ancient lake beds or old riverbanks to better understand past environmental conditions, and of course, to look for evidence of past life. And if the meteorite ALH84001 taught us anything, it is that even with samples in the laboratory, signs of life can be ambiguous. And it takes a collection of scientific disciplines to come to robust conclusions. Without samples, something as important as evidence of life on another planet will be hotly debated by scientists and non-scientists alike until we can get the physical evidence into the laboratory. The study of Mars over the last 150-plus years has been littered with what some might call improper conclusions, or even mistakes. There are no Martian-built canali on Mars. But without the poor optics of early telescopes that led to the ideas of canali, Nikola Tesla would not have devoted his time to contacting Martians, leading to his development of radio controls. Percival Lowell would not have sunk a fortune into building the Lowell Observatory. Creative minds would not have written about life on other planets, inspiring countless dreamers to think beyond Earth. Similarly, we do not yet have evidence that life exists or has existed anywhere outside of Earth. But had the microfossils of ALH-84001 not stirred up the scientific community at large, how much less would we understand about life on Earth or its possibilities elsewhere? Would we have developed the capabilities to land large spacecraft on other planets? Would interdisciplinary scientific research be at the impressive stage it is today? It's impossible to replay history with these changes, but these missteps also provide good examples of what the field of science is, an ongoing search to understand the natural world. Science is a process that experiences hiccups. Individual hypotheses and individual studies can be wrong, but as long as we continue to search as a scientific community, the field evolves toward a better understanding of our surroundings, oftentimes in extremely exciting ways.